I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. If you love listening to this show as much as I love hosting it, I think you'll really like the Medal of Honor podcast, produced in partnership with the Medal of Honor Museum. Each episode talks about a genuine American hero and the actions that led to their receiving our nation's highest award for valor. They're just a few minutes each, so if you're looking for a show to fill time between these Warriors episodes, I think you'll love the Medal of Honor podcast. Search for the Medal of Honor podcast wherever you get your shows. Thanks. I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Last episode, we heard Major General Frederick Boots Blessé tell the whole story behind No Guts, No Glory, and explain how dogfighting has changed over the years. Today, in the final episode of this three-part series, we'll hear Blessé talk about what inspired him to join the Air Force, what makes a good pilot, and the story behind how he met his childhood hero, the famous World War I pilot, Eddie Rickenbacker.
Dogfighting kind of happened. There are a number of different examples or theories as to exactly when it started. I can only tell you the one that I've always accepted and that I thought made the most sense, and that was at first they had all the flying over Germany and over the part of France was done by observation airplanes. And these were not armed. They were flown by individuals and may or may not initially have had a second guy in the back, but some did and some didn't. And that even got to the point where occasionally a French or one of the airplanes from one nation would go by and the two of them would go by and they'd wave at each other. The guy in the back cockpit would wave at him. And then that went on a little while. And then one day, one of the guys in the back cockpit pulled out a pistol and started firing at the other airplane. And that's what really started it. I mean, that ripped it. And then there was a little more of that. And then the single-engine aircraft arrived on the scene. In our world, with armaments that's not very lethal, but it was significant. It was a hell of a lot better than a punch in the belly. 30 caliber machine guns that would fire about 600 rounds. And you had to be within probably 600 feet of the guy to hit him. You couldn't be firing. There would be no use at all trying to fire at him with a 30 caliber out at 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet like you could do with a 20 millimeter gun or something like that. So the fighters arrived on the scene because the guy in the back was firing. And then the fighters themselves decided that they would get the observation plane. And then the next step was they had to have somebody to keep the fighter off so the other nation bring their fighters out and would give fighter protection to the observation plane. And so pretty soon, one group of fighters is fighting the other group of fighters, and most of the time the observation plane would go home and the other guys were fighting it out. There are a number of things that all go into the makeup of a good fighter pilot, the things that would maybe make him become an ace. And I think in my book, the most important thing is the desire to engage the enemy, the desire to do it, not just willing to do it, but the desire to do it. And if you stop and think about it, of all the fighter pilots that were trained, I read this just recently. Of all of them that were trained, I think it's only 5% of them got into combat. And those that got into combat, only 5/10,000 of them became aces. So your chances of becoming an ace of having the qualities and the things that were necessary to become an ace were apparently very rare indeed compared to the whole shebang, you know. You'd be surprised how many guys really didn't want to. When I got in the squadron, I'll digress just a moment, but when I got in that squadron in Korea, I thought every guy is going to, you know, he's going to be there. He wants to get up there and get... It didn't work out that way. And after I'd been there at about a month, I'd had all the pilots categorized. And we had, I think there were 32 pilots in the squadron. And there were about six of them that amounted to about 90% of all the kills, about six of us. And then there were about another 15, maybe 15 or 18, that were all in the process. And one of these days would become one of the sixth. Well, we go home, the other guys are they get more aggressive as they get more experience, and they become one of the six. But the other, now you got about 10 left. And out of those 10, you aren't going to get those guys in a fight. I don't care what you do. If they're up there with the MiGs, they'll always have a fuel tank that won't drop, or something's vibrating, something's not right, you know? And I was amazed at this every man a tiger business is really not true. There are a lot of pussycats up there. Bud Anderson, in my opinion, is probably one of the few really elite fighter pilots. He knew what he was doing. He was careful. He was aggressive without being careless. He was just as good a fighter pilot as you could ever want to know.
Hello everyone, my name is Tom Kearns and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Rickenbacker was my idol, so I read a lot of things about him and what he did and how he got into combat and what he was flying and that sort of thing. As an individual, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker was really a very, very unusual guy. He pulled himself up totally by his own bootstraps time after time after time. He was able to maneuver himself into a better job, a better position, more money, this sort of thing. And that was out of a very, very austere beginning. His family, his father did not make a lot of money, had a good father and a good mother, although his father was very hard on him, he and his brother. And he was not what you'd call an ideal young kid. I mean, he was caught stealing stuff a couple times, and you know, you would have thought, looking at his first 10 or 12 or 13 years, he's heading in the wrong direction. His father got in a fight with a guy, and the guy killed him. And his mother didn't work, and his older brother was not really the quality to jump in and take over things. And Eddie, who was 14, quit school, got himself a job. There's no way to keep the house or to keep things going if he didn't do it. So he got himself a job. He was working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, trying to keep his house and his family and everything all fed and keep them together. He finally got a better job. And eventually, because his father had taught him about tools and things like that, he turned out to be a master mechanic. And he was then hired as a mechanic, as a driver's assistant, the driver's mechanic in the race cars. And, of course, his objective was to move over. He wanted to do the racing, and he began doing that. By the time about 1916 came along, and the war was going, and our people were eventually starting to go over there to fly, he was making $60,000, which is equivalent of over $1 million in these days. That was in 1916. He was making over $60,000 a year. He quit that, took a job as a sergeant in the Air Force and as a driver because they told him he couldn't get in the Air Service. He felt, if I get over there, somehow or another, I can work my way into it. And that's the way he did everything. He just continued to work his way all the way up. He was a remarkable guy. He got over there, ended up being the personal driver for General Billy Mitchell. Through Billy Mitchell thought he was great, that he did good. He did a lot of minor things that were good and all that. And one day Mitchell was going to a very, very important meeting, and they gave him a car, gave him an old Hudson. And Mitchell didn't like that, but that was the only thing they had, and Eddie was driving it, Captain Eddie. And sure enough, they got part way down there, and the car broke down. And Mitchell was through the roof. He was going to miss this important meeting. He had to be there. And Captain Eddie went in there, and he took a few things apart, substituted a couple things, and in about 30 minutes, he had the car ready to go again and got him to the meeting. And that really impressed Colonel Mitchell. So Mitchell agreed to give him a try in the Air Service, even though he was, well, he lied about his age, said he was 25. He was really 27, and that was 2 years too late. But He got into the Air Service, and they spent a long time trying to get trained, and they went to a French airfield that didn't have any facilities, and all these American pilots would come in thinking they were going to have pilot training, and they ended up building hangars, and they ended up being construction people. And they finally got the thing squared away, and then they began getting airplanes, and then the guys didn't like Eddie because in his squadron because they were all aristocrats. The final name of it was the Lafayette Esquadrille, and it was full of millionaire sons and people like that, and he had a kind of a funny accent and was a little gruff and didn't use the proper English all the time. And he was not very well liked until he finally he started getting kills, and the next thing you know, he got to be squadron commander, and he moved on up just by his own bootstraps from about August, I think it was. In August or early September of 1918, he still only had about seven or eight kills. And then in October, he got about 14 kills in October when he was the squadron commander. And he revamped how everybody was going to do it and what the jobs were in the squadron and how they were going to fly. He totally worked them over. He wanted desperately to be the best ace, to be the leading ace, and to be the ace of aces in the American Air Service. That drove him from dropping off $1 million income in these days, a drop of $60,000 a year income, and taking a sergeant's job and going over, thinking all the time, if I get over there and get close to it, somehow or another, I'll work myself into it. That's the thing that made him great. He had a tremendous desire to be the leading ace and to fly fighters, and he knew he could do it. And God, the airplanes, when I read about the kind of airplanes that those guys went into service with, I mean, you wouldn't believe it. It's just, initially, he was flying a Newport 28. And it didn't have a throttle in it. It had a little thing that you could set. It was a rotary, had a rotary engine, so you could pull the thing back and several cylinders would quit, pull it back further and several more would quit. And that's the way you reduce speed, by stopping part of the engine, you know, and they could put it all the way back and the whole damn thing would quit. But they went in to fight in those things. And he did it. He got kills. He did a good job of it. And then finally they put him over in the SPAD 13 and he got most of his kills there in late October of 1918. He was a good dogfighter because he believed in the airplane that he flew, in spite of the fact that it wasn't good, and he knew it. You can pull the wing fabric off of that Newport that he had. It had all kinds of things wrong with it, things that we would never think of going. And he knew, he got in and he learned the airplane. He got with the mechanics. He learned what things were good and bad about the airplane so that he knew what he could do with the airplane without getting in a lot of trouble. He got the Medal of Honor for attacking a seven-ship flight, five of which were the Fokker D-8s. It was the best fighter the Germans had. And he shot down one of them and then got in between the two. By this time, the observation airplanes had machine guns. And he got in between them, and it looked like he was going to get hammered. So he took this one, and the guy started to turn away from him. He took him and took a big lead on him and fired him and shot him down and then took off and went home. Got two kills out of the thing without getting hit himself. He was quite a guy. I met him. Like I say, I knew something about him when I was 8 years old. I was born in 1921. 1929, 1930, my father was in the Army, and we were stationed at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. There was an airfield there, Army airfield, and the guy that lived down the hall, a captain, took me up in an airplane down there, and I really loved it. I thought it was great. But I knew that I wanted to be like him. And he was my knight in shining armor from the time I was about 8 years old. Nothing ever happened. I was delighted to be lucky enough to accomplish that. In 1953, after I had come home, I was a leading ace, and they tabbed to me. I was on speaking tours, and they gave me an F-86, and I was doing air shows at some place, and I was putting on an air show in Richmond, Virginia. And they didn't have any fuel for me, so I had no drop tanks. I had to go up, put on the air show, and then go over to Langley, 40 miles away, and land and get fuel, and then come back and get ready for the next show. And I had just done that. I put on a show, went over and got gas at Langley, came back and landed. And I hadn't even gotten away from the airplane, and some guy drove up in a car, looked like a pretty, like one of these oddball cars, I don't know, expensive cars. And he came over and he said, listen, we've got a Captain Eddie Rickenbacker from Eastern Airlines coming in about 20 minutes. And we were wondering, we want to tow a SPAD over and put it under the wing of your F-86 and see if, and we'll get him to come over and get a picture of the two of you like that. And he said, would you mind if we did that? And I said, would I mind? I said, if you want somebody to push that airplane of his over with his nose, I'll do it. I was so enthusiastic about it. I couldn't wait. He came over, and they still hadn't quite gotten the airplanes in shape yet. And Captain Eddie and I stood there on the ramp beside the two airplanes, and we talked about, he was extremely interested in the terrific speeds we had in the jets and the fact that I had gotten some kills in jets. And of course, I was questioning him on everything I could think about. It was really great. And they took a nice picture of the two of us. And I'll tell you, I got copies of that picture from all over the world, from friends of mine. I got them with that had nothing but German written under them or nothing but Japanese. There was the same picture. It's all the writing under it is in Japanese or it's German or it's French or something. But that picture really got a lot of publicity. We had this talk, as I say, we talked back and forth for, I would guess, at least 30 minutes, maybe 30 to 40 minutes. And then he went back and got back in his airplane, and I took off and was ready to go on another show. About a week later, 10 days later maybe, I got a nice letter from him. He said how much he enjoyed meeting me and talking with me and talking about the new things in jet aviation and jet fighters. And he said, and he sent me this 8x10 picture of that was going all around the world. They had sent him copies of it. I didn't have one. And he said he wondered if would I sign this for him so he could put it in his den. And I said, me? I can't believe this. So, yeah, I autographed it, sent it back to him, and said, I'm only doing this under the provision that you will send me one back to. And about a week or 10 days later, I got another nice one from him and signed it to my good friend, Major Blesse, something at the bottom I've got from the inside at Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. That's my probably of 40 pictures and stuff that I got hanging around my den. That's my most prized possession there. If I was in a hurry and the house was on fire and the house had blown off, the roof had blown off, and I could only get one picture, that's the one I'd go get before I left.
That was Major General Frederick Boots Blissey. If you haven't already, make sure to check out part 1 and 2 of this series. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcast.com. We're always looking to improve the show. For updates and more, follow us on Twitter at @team_Harbaugh. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with The Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloia, and David Moss.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.